You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and apologies for the state of my voice. It's due to another excellent Glastonbury festival and all the attendant shouting, screaming and extremes. And that was just the parenting. So sorry, I'm a little bit scratchy today. From me, though, we segue smoothly to someone who has a fine voice for singing, improv, characters, and all sorts of other incredible, elastic and flexible performative things. This is the brilliant Pippa Evans. Before we get into Pippa, just a reminder, there is 1 week left of the new Polly Becker designed horse t-shirts, pre-sales discount for all your merch from ComediansComedian.com. Go to ComediansComedian.com/merch. There is still 1 week left of the pre-sale of these sweet tees before they go on sale at regular price. So go there and check them out. Now, though, the brilliant Pippa Evans. Are you going off at the moment?
What's
you,
that mean?
Have you just like, is it all going off at the moment? Are you doing London Palladium?
I did live at the London Palladium last, it came out a couple of weeks ago.
Okay, yeah. I haven't seen that, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. No, I don't expect you to see much of my stuff actually, because we're often either at the same time or also that thing of when I stopped, I think we gigged when I was being Loretta mainly.
Yes.
And then I sort of stopped doing that.
Yes.
And so then I've sort of gone off into my own little world.
Well, there's a ton of YouTube stuff of you doing Loretta.
Yeah.
Either at gigs or stuff that you've produced and made music videos.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's, if you search Pippa Evans stand-up, there's very, very little.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's mostly Loretta.
Yeah.
But I did see your Edinburgh show. I saw Same Same But Different.
Oh, did they give it? Did, oh, you came?
Yes, I did. I snuck in.
Okay, great.
Yes, yes. I snuck in and sweated in Bannerman's with everyone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's all sort of changing, really. I feel like comedy is like a Venn diagram of all the different bits of your life, and you have to find this point where all the Venn diagram, all the circles meet, and then you find that little bit in the middle, and you go, "There's my voice."
Ah, that's a lovely way of putting it. Flesh out that metaphor for me. What sorts of things are in the circles?
So for me, so obviously music is a big part of what I do, and I love it. But I also love doing talking stand up. But I never just want to be a pure stand up, which I think I wrestled with for a long time because, as you will know, as a stand up person, that stand ups often make jokes which are, you're not a real comedian, and because I worry a lot, I would think, they're right, I'm not a real comedian, I must talk more. So I would worry about that. And then I sort of stopped worrying about it and went, well, no, what I want to do is make sure that each of those circles is as strong as each other.
Okay.
So it's like, okay, so I've got my musical comedy circle, I've got my talking stand-up circle, and I've got my improv circle. And I just needed to find a place where those three things met. There's also this fourth circle for me, which is like, so it's probably the same as improv, but it's this sort of, people, I really like people. So how do you do a sort of big influence for me is like Michael Barrymore's My Kind of People and Brian Connolly show from the 90s. Like those, okay. Those were the shows I loved.
I think I've seen My Kind of People, but what is it?
My Kind of People was where he would be like, he'd just meet some producers would have found some like kid who's had a hard time, and he'd talk to them and then have a joke together, and they'd go, "You can sing though, can't you, Mary?" Mary would get up and sing a song, and it was just really lovely. It was like such a nice program. So there's something about that kind of enjoying the audience as much as me. So I suppose rather than it being all about me, it being like, well, here's me, but let's see how we can get you involved in a way that's actually sharing the space rather than I own the whole space.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does make sense.
Yeah, so sort of how do you get those four circles to meet in the middle? And I think we're finally getting there, which is exciting.
So talk to me about the blocks in between. When you say we're finally getting there, what sorts of things were impeding getting there?
Okay, so, when I was doing it live at the London Palladium, I had a really long conversation with Bradley Walsh about how I should have been a red coat or a blue coat. I think he was a blue coat. I can't remember which one he was.
What's the difference?
One is Butlins and one is Pontins.
Fine.
These
are, for the benefit of the uninitiated,
the entertainers at the holiday camps, which is where Brian Connolly, Bradley Walsh, Shane Ritchie, all those classic entertainer types came from.
People who have done a bit of stand-up, but they're entertainers, not comedians.
Yeah, so
but they fulfil, like, they're sort of culturally quite significant in the UK.
But also I've heard you talk on your podcast before about that battle between the entertainer and the comedian. And I've often had that battle with myself because I am more of an entertainer than a comedian, I'd say. And I think for ages I was like, I don't know where I fit. I don't know who I am. And then I think there's such a kind of a breath of fresh air that comes in when you realize everybody has that thing and it just takes time. And then once you get that, you can relax and you feel much better about it all. I can't remember which question I was answering.
So you were talking to Brian Connolly.
Bradley Walsh.
Bradley Walsh, sorry.
So I was talking to Bradley Walsh about how I should have been a red coat. He was like, it's weird, isn't it? That's just not a thing that's offered to middle-class girls who went to a private school, that, you know, you're never going to finish school, and they go, right, not university for you, you need to go and be a red coat. That should have been what my career advice should have been. But then I told my dad about it, and he said, yeah, but you, at one point you wanted to be a serious actress. And I was like, I think that was a cover-up. I think it was a real cover-up of I want to be a comedian.
Yeah, totally.
But you go, I don't know how to be a comedian, but there's a clear path to be an actor. So that's a bit easier. And also there's something frightening. It's much easier to do the thing you're less interested in than it is to be the thing you definitely know you want to be. So, you know, my influences, like I say, were these entertainers and Victoria Wood. And so this kind of character side of things. Maybe that's the other circle of my Venn diagram. Maybe there's five circles to it. I think the more circles, the harder it is to find that middle point.
Yes.
Trying to find these things. So the block for me was listening too much to advice. So listening too much to other people, like what you should do, rather than just going, I think I know what I need to do. But it's much easier if someone says, do this, and you do it, and it fails, then you can go, it's their fault, not my fault.
Totally right, yeah.
So that was a bit of a block for me. And also, I think once you start doing something, it's basically Theresa May's problem, which is, I said I was going to do this, so I'm going to do this, rather than, I said I'm going to do this, and so... But it doesn't really work anymore, so I'm going to start trying something else. So it took a long time for me to drop Loretta Main, even though I felt quite uncomfortable with it for a while, because it was going really well and people love it. So you go, oh, well, if it's successful, surely then I should be happy. But it doesn't work like that, Stuart.
Okay, let's stay with that for a bit, because as you said, I've seen you do Loretta several times.
Mm.
And so Loretta Main is, in your words, who is she?
Loretta Main is a country grunge singer, I would call her, and she is just pissed off with the world, and she cannot understand why she's not a superstar, even though it's clearly her attitude and the fact that she's always drunk, and that she is just really angry.
And was she one of the first characters that you did, or was she one of the first?
No, she was one of the first things that people really responded to. So I have a load of other characters I did in that show. That was from my Edinburgh show 2008, which was called Pippa Evans and Other Lonely People.
And I remember one of them had a brilliant name, like Amandula.
That's right, Amandula.
Yeah.
So Amandula was very popular with comedians and some audiences, but other people couldn't really get it because I can't really explain what she was. She was just a lady who had her skirt pulled up, just my mum's old skirt pulled up really high, and I still have it. And she was off of them party rings, and she lived with her cat Max, and just spoke. Every line was a punchline set up, but it was like a really well crafted character, but would never go anywhere. Kind of a bit like I suppose like Angelos. You know how Dan Skinner had to put Angelos, who is a character off the reboot of Shooting Stars. He had him 15 years ago, but we had to put him in a drawer because everyone was like, what are you going to do with that?
Yes.
So I suppose in some ways I've put Loretta in a drawer rather than I've dismissed her entirely.
Okay.
It was just that. So Loretta I did for in that show, and people just went, wow, this is really great, because I can actually sing and I can write songs. So it really worked as a character in a club. Because I think when you do a character in a club, there needs to be a real reason why they're there. Like, I hate when they go, oh, it's just passing by, and the contest that I could have 10 minutes, rather than I'm a singer who's just been allowed on this bill. So she worked really well in that context. Interesting fact for you. So I discovered Loretta when I was first starting out, and I would work a lot with Luke Tolson. And me, him, and Holly Walsh were going to do a thing together in 2000 and must have been seven or something.
I love it. I love hearing about cabals of years past. Yeah. Go on.
And Holly then was like, I'm too busy, I can't do it. But we'd already booked a 20-minute slot at some character night. And it's so funny in those early days when you go, well, we can't let them down, like as if the world will end, rather than ringing them up and saying, I'm really sorry, but we've lost our
member. Why don't you give it to one of the 100 people on the reserve list?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So me and Luke were like, okay, what can we do well between the two of us in 2 days' time? And I said, well, I can sing and you're very sarcastic, so why don't you interview me as a singer? And so I just wrote a few songs very quickly. And then he interviewed me. And originally she was a Kiwi. So Loretta Mine was originally really quite positive. But she said all these quite nasty things, so it didn't quite work. But I could feel there was something in it at that gig. And then I did a gig maybe like a week later. And I just thought, I'll just try America and see what happens. And it was just like, all came together, to the point that people were scared of me and thought I really was, because I did it at a few nights that weren't comedy nights, that were sort of mixed Billy kind of things.
Yes.
So people would just thought I was this hideous woman who'd come
over.
And
it's kind of introduced at face value, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. There's no, and I don't let up. I'm not like Marcel. So like in terms of when I come off stage, I will be Pippa, and I have no problem with people knowing it's a character, because I still think it's as funny once you know it's a character.
Sure.
So I think it works either way, but people really responded well to it. So
just before we go into, and I'm really fascinated with this idea of you feeling like you should keep doing something because it was successful, I want to put a pin in that. But before we get onto that, just talk a bit more about what it was about Loretta that was working so well. So it was, she was there for a, she had a reason to be there.
So it's a reason to be there. She had a really clear worldview, which mm-hmm. I think is really important, whether particularly with a character of, And it's performed really well. So it's like it's a fully fleshed out character. And like I say, the songs I can sing. So it's reasonable to believe that I maybe am a singer. My American accent is really good. So people could believe that I was American. You wouldn't necessarily question where I'm from.
Yes.
So,
and you can look, she was a character that was the voice, the personality of the character was, you could look at her. I mean, when I think of Loretta, I think of like that album cover or like the poster with the mascara everywhere. Yeah. You look at it, you go, I know exactly what that is.
You know
I know
exactly
what she thinks about
she
everything.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, she wasn't a character, I don't think, that kind of surprised us with her worldview.
Her
songs, the ones I remember about like, loving someone so much, you want to trap them in a box and keep them there forever. And that
And then I think I did three solo shows with Loretta. And then as it grew, the songs became more diverse, because I also, my friend Duncan, so Duncan Walsh Atkins, who writes a lot of my songs for the Now Show, which is a radio, BBC radio show with me, is it candid is the way of saying it? That he was like, yeah, when I first saw it, I thought, well, this is not going to last because it's only angry love songs and that's never going to go anywhere. And it was good that he said that, because it made me go, oh yeah, so let's look at some different ways of how does she do other things in life. So let's look at her backstory. Let's look at her ambition. Let's look at her hobbies, her pets, you know, all the other bits of life. So really, really fleshing her out. So she could have a sitcom if you wanted. She could write memoirs, all mm-hmm. that kind of stuff.
Okay. And it seemed to me from the outside, I suppose my preconception is that you kind of performed what I'm terming, and what I hope catches on, you performed a Brodkin. You kind of took you took an existing character, which was doing great, and then sort of stepped back from it. And I think for a while, were you almost doing the same songs, but as you?
And when I started being me?
When you started being you, did you kind of step back for Loretta, but still try to use the material? And kind of, that's what I mean by Brodkin,
right,
Lee Nelson, kind of like, there's the character. I'm still that character, but I'm not as much that character because that doesn't suit the purpose anymore.
Well, interesting. So there's a cut. I probably only do two or three songs of Loretta's now. And that's because they, that, so what started me questioning Loretta was that more and more her material was me. And okay. I started going, yeah. Yeah, I don't think Loretta would think, I think I'm trying to push myself like a cocoon. Like I like the idea of Loretta as my safety cocoon as I was developing my own voice. And it's like, yes. So the comedy world will accept this because it's a package and it's really, you know, and I love performing live. I think that's really important to say. And so for me, the fear was like, you won't be able to perform live because people, you know, quite rightly, I think, and sometimes wrongly, but generally promoters go, well, I don't know what Pippa Evans is, but I know what Loretta Main is. Yeah. And I know that audience was like that. And at the end of the day, they need to have a satisfied audience. And I take that very much, very seriously. Like I'm really, I feel like the audience, we have such a responsibility as performers for audiences nights out and that they've, you know, paid that money for a babysitter and tickets. And we need to make sure they have a good time, whatever that good time manifests itself as. So I think that's what the cocoon was. It was like, okay, well, I can't go out and perform as me while I'm being a bit shit.
Okay.
So Loretta was something I really enjoyed doing for a long, long time and then ended up finding it frustrating.
Yes. And the reason for that frustration was pure, was it solely to do with the inability of her voice to express things you wanted to express?
Yeah, I think so. Especially because I'm actually quite a calm, happy person. And I'm also married and live in a flat. And I'm quite bored. Like a lot of time I'd be doing her tweets of like, oh my God, I just got out of a skip. And I'd be in bed with a cup of tea, you know. And I was like, so there's fun in one way. But in the other way, I was like, I sort of feel like this is a voice we know. So what's the voice that I'm not giving my voice, which isn't that I have. And I think a long time I was strangled by, I have nothing to say. Like I've got no point to make.
As Pippa.
Yeah. But Loretta doesn't have any point to make, except that she's fucking pissed off.
Yes.
So why do I feel like I have to make a point? It's like, no, you don't have to make, you just need to make people laugh. That's your purpose as a comedian, is to make people laugh. You can make a point if you want, but you don't have to be making a point.
Let's look at this from the idea of, from the perspective of a voice.
Mm.
Because I don't know that Loretta was making a point so much as having a very clear voice. And are you trying to find a similar clarity of voice as Pippa? Or are you kind of content for what you do to simply, for what you do to be what you do?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think my voice is the contradiction of my voice, literally. So my opening joke is always, I suffer from posh voice, no money.
Yeah.
Because people hear my voice and assume I was sort of a child who had a pony.
Yeah.
Because people hear me speak, and I think again that was maybe what Loretta was about as well. Was like, I can't go on stage and speak like this when I'm not really posh like, say, Miles Jupp plays or Simon Evans. They do this whole sort of grand thing, and I'm not like Cockney. So that tick box thing I find really difficult because yes. I'm not a tick box. I'm a bit of a sort of mongrel. So I'm not like, oh, the working classes, and I'm not, oh, England, it should be like how it used to be. But then now I really embrace that and go, actually, I'm such a confused person because I was brought up listening to Gilbert and Sullivan and Chaz and Dave. So how am I supposed to know what my voice is?
Yes.
Because I've got so many voices in me, which is probably why I'm so good at doing voices and also why I'm really good at hearing someone talk about something and going, oh yeah, that sounds interesting. Oh yeah, I think I really agree with you. And then hearing someone else, and I go, oh no, that sounds quite interesting. I'm like you. And I think a lot of people feel like that, actually. A lot of people are going through life going, who am I?
Yes.
Which is why all the musicals have songs called Who Am I?
Yeah.
And so realizing that actually everyone is continuing to figure out who they are until they die. Like even I talk to my parents, and they still feel like they're not quite sure what their purpose in life is, like you're in your 70s.
Yes, God, I would have hoped. I don't know if that makes me feel good to hear that people in their 70s still worry about that.
But I don't think they're worried about it. It's the fact that you accept it. You go, you go, actually, and also the fact that we need to be comfortable, the fact we don't know who we are for longer. So that fact that, again, I think it's like something to do with how we were taught at school, like, what are you going to be? I'm going to be a fireman. Great. That's it. Your choice has been made. That's who you are. It's like, why are we making 10-year-olds make these decisions?
Yeah.
It should be, what would you like to start life off being and then decide you don't want to do anymore?
Yes. I mean, that is not taught as a precept of life, is
no.
it? That almost everyone does a thing for a bit and then changes.
Yeah, yeah. And even people that have ended
up... Or maybe almost everyone we know. I mean, are there still people that just do one thing?
Yeah, there are, because I've got friends who have done just one thing. But that choice, they've made that choice often consciously. I mean, so we are talking about a group of people who have the ability to make that choice because they're not
yes.
forced into something.
Sure.
But they've made that choice so they can make other choices. So I've got a friend who works 9 to 5, does not care about their job because they love partying and going to festivals and socializing and being with family and friends. That's why. So they see work simply as a thing to do. Whereas I think as a performer, I think we find that really hard to understand. Like, but why would you do something that you don't worry about 24/7, that
yes.
you're not really passionate about, that you don't wake up in the middle of the night and go, chutney, that was the answer.
Yes,
quick, write it down.
It's very difficult. If anyone ever would say to me, oh, it's just a job.
Mm.
No, you fundamentally don't understand. But it is just a job, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Maybe uncoupling that idea of like, this is every fibre of my being.
Yeah, well, I think it's like letting, it can be every fibre of your being as long as occasionally you can put it down. So if it's every fibre of your being and it's making you ill, then maybe we need to step back from it. So I sort of feel like, again, this is the contradiction of the best performers are the ones who put their full heart and soul into it, but are, I think, generally also able to then go to a baby shower or a family picnic or something and not be sitting there going, I hate all these people.
So this is Pippa. Lots more to talk about with her coming up shortly. We'll talk about Sunday Assembly, which is a bewilderingly successful thing that she set up with Sanderson Jones, formerly a comedian. And I'm not going to even try and describe it. I'll leave that up to her. That's coming up. And we'll also talk a bit more about Showstopper and all of the other bits and bobs she's doing, including her Edinburgh Fringe show. Now, not only am I going to be at the Fringe this year with Like I Mean It, the new hour, the 7th. Christ, can it be 7 hours? The 7th hour of stand-up comedy in my own personal repertoire, which is, of course, 3:45 daily at the Liquid Rooms Annex from the 5th to the 27th of the festival, because August might as well be called Edinburgh. But not only will I be up there with a bunch of other of my recent guests, and indeed my forthcoming guests, including Barry Cryer, Simon Munnery, and plenty of other people besides, but I will also be doing Everyone's a Comedian. Now, this is a thing, a comedy experiment that we here at Comedians Comedian, by which I mean mostly me, have devised in an attempt to... Well, what is it an attempt to do? It's really just an attempt to have an idea and make it exist as a physical thing in the real world. As soon as I had the idea, I sort of felt I couldn't not do it. I know lots of you have comedy aspirations, and I know lots of you are professional comedians and indeed newbie and aspiring comedians, but some of you will never perform through choice because you've got far too much on your plate, or because you don't want to, or because you find the fear crippling, or any one of 100 other reasons. But that doesn't mean you're not funny. It doesn't mean you can't generate the beginnings of something, the beginnings of an idea that could go on to be funny. So I have thrust myself into the spotlight. I won't call it the limelight because, let's face it, this could go horribly wrong. But what I'm going to do is perform an hour entirely crowdsourced from your material. Now, remember, you can't submit to this if you have ever performed or if you're... I mean, I was going to say if you ever will. Who knows what will happen in the future. But the point is, this is not for comedians. This is for that section of the listenership of this podcast who are real people, civilians, the proper jobberati. If you have ever come up with some stuff, or if you ever see a thing and think, oh, I've always thought that'd be funny, or you've come up with a little one-liner or a dad joke, these are not Creative Commons things. These are not pub jokes or existing funny things. This is just things that you've thought yourself, then you can submit it and I will perform it. And I'm only going to see the material. I think what we're going to do is I'm going to see it an hour before I go on. So I get the chance to go, right, that's that, that's that. We might even reduce that further. It might be more fun if it was 5 minutes. Because let's face it, I'm getting pretty scared. I contacted Daryl, to whom all your submissions are currently sent. And I said, should I be worried? He said, we've had a good few submissions. And he said, some of them, what was his exact words? Some of them are god awful, but there are some gems, so that's good. Now, I don't mean to put any of you off. What does Daryl know about comedy? He's just an editor of a podcast or two podcasts and a comedian. But what does a comedian know about comedy? What do any of us? This is sort of the point. I would love you to send in your stuff. It's comedianscomedian.com/experiment. And on one night only, once at this year's Edinburgh Festival, I will perform the stuff and try to get to the kernel of your idea and try to make it funny. And I'm not going to go up there and slag you off. I feel bad now that I've said Daryl said it was god-awful. Daryl, maybe you should remove this bit. No, keep it in. There will be integrity. Actually, Daryl, does that drop you in it? Cox, it probably does a bit, doesn't it? I like the jeopardy of pointing out that that some of them are bad. I think, there'd be no jeopardy in this if everyone was just writing in brilliant stuff. But we don't want to betray the listener. And besides, who is the arbiter of comedy? Just because you don't like it, Daryl, doesn't mean it's good. Daryl, please keep in this entire bit of me talking to you. I think it reveals a layer of integrity to the podcast that we should stick with. So listen, here's the thing. I'm going to perform the stuff. It's going to be a lot of fun. And the point of me doing it is not to mock you or make fun of you. The point of me doing it is to attempt to wield my own comedy skill and experience to try and get to grips with what it is about what you've submitted that you find funny. There we go. We should, Daryl, we're definitely leaving this in because I've just nailed the premise. That's what we're trying to do. So submit your stuff. And you can also tick a little box there that it basically says it's okay with you if I record it and then make it available for free later. That's the plan. Also, the stuff goes back to being yours and I don't intend to turn it into a thing of my own. You're not going to see me doing it on Conan years from now. That's absolutely not the plan. But there it is. So that's that. That was as rambling and bewildering an introduction to the premise as you could expect from me. So you know where to go for that. And thank you for your donations, of course. I'd like to thank Andrew, who says, thanks for all your hard work. Glad finally to have joined the 2%. That's very kind of you, Andrew. That's a reference to the number of you that actually donate, and I'm very pleased about it too. Someone called Darren says, that's not a polite way of doing it. Let's go again. Darren says, I own too many t-shirts now, but I wanted to make an equivalent expression of support. Keep up the good work. Well, thank you very much for your donation, Darren. If you would like to support the show with a regular subscription, or if you would like to donate with a one-off donation, you can do them all at comedianscomedian.com/donate. And remember, currently you are the only thing that keeps this podcast going. So if you're a t-shirt user or wearer, get a t-shirt as part of the pre-sale running for one more week or just afterwards for slightly more money at comedianscomedian.com/merch or go to /donate and you can set up your own means of supporting the show because that's the only reason I get to go to Montreal and LA the last couple of years and exciting places like that and bring back new and exciting interviews with new and exciting comedians. And it also helps me pay the people who help me along the show, who help me edit it and make it possible, because let's face it, as the varying demands of parenthood and cranking out another hour and also not simply cranking out another hour, because let's not forget, it would be hard enough to simply crank out another hour that was fine, and that's not what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to rewrite the rule book every single time, and that takes time, and time costs money. So if you enjoy the show, if you enjoy the work, the research that goes into this podcast, and you would like to support it, then please do donate to it. Thank you to all of you that have. That will do for now. Let's get back to Pippa Evans, and I'll have a quick post-amble chat with you after we conclude the interview. Back to Pippa.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is the summer to expand your horizons. It's time to explore. But before you set foot out the door, set foot in the ultimate travel shoes from Allbirds. Like the breathable, silky smooth tree dasher, the responsive foam and extra grip of the tree runner, or the classic low-top look of the tree piper. Allbirds has a lightweight, ultra-packable shoe ready for whatever adventures you have planned. Boarding pass? Check. Passport? Check. The perfect travel shoe? Check. Find your perfect pair at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.
Is this question of what is your comic voice, is that sort of resolved for you now? Do you feel that you have found your comic voice as much as Loretta had hers?
No. I think it's just a bigger project, isn't it? If you want to do it. I think for me, if you want to be the best performer you could ever be, you should probably never say, I've found my comic voice.
Yeah, well, I don't want to trick anyone. I do worry about people listening going, oh, have you? But I mean to your satisfaction or to
your... No. Well, and I don't think I'll ever be satisfied either. So I'm also in Showstopper, the improvised musical, which I know we haven't talked about yet, but probably works in this context because we've been working on that show for 10 years. And we won an Olivier last year, and we're the first improv show ever to win an Olivier. And for me, that the reason we won that Olivier is because we work so freaking hard on that show. We constantly practice our skills and are constantly pushing to improvise a musical to a West End standard, which means we have to keep pushing and pushing and pushing, and we can never rest on our laurels, which sounds exhausting, but it's so satisfying because we're all working together and all so passionate about the project. And in the same way, I feel like... So I feel like I'm really happy with where I'm at, with what I'm doing. And I'm really pleased that I found the beginnings or a safe space or whatever of my voice. So I'm in a place where I know what my voice is to an extent, but we can hone and hone and hone until I think that I can write. I'd like to get to a point where I could like write instantly in my voice, but I really write longhand and have to edit a hell of a lot to get the material out. And I don't know if that's ever going to change, but I feel like I could definitely write less. Does that make any sense?
You could spend less time writing and do better stuff, do you mean?
As in, because I think if I was slightly more focused, maybe I could write more. But then when I think about that, when I wrote Loretta and I knew exactly what her voice was, I'd write for ages. So maybe that's just how I write, is I write loads and loads of shit and then edit it down. I generally write about 3 hours for every hour.
Yes, okay.
So 3 to 1.
Are you writing, when you say out longhand, a pen?
With a pen. I'm a pen and paper kind of person.
Have you got stacks of
stacks and stacks of notebooks. I think there's tons over there. Loads of books. I keep all my notebooks.
And do you write, are you disciplined in your writing? Do you do a certain number of hours a day, week, anything like that?
No, not at all. Because I do so many different things, which is also, I think, also why it's taken a long time to get the Venn diagram squishing down means that I just write when I can, and when I often block out like a week or something and say, right, this week I'm going to do this. But it's not disciplined in a kind of everyday. I've so many times I've tried to do, I think it's called the Richard Herring technique, where you mark an X on the day and then the next...
As Seinfeld, I believe.
Is it Seinfeld?
Yeah.
Sorry, Richard.
All due respect to Rich. And I'm sure Seinfeld didn't invent it, but he certainly popularised it. He said, it's the chain. You have to...
That's the chain,
You have to make a little cross on every day of your calendar and you wrote, and your only job is to make sure that the chain never breaks.
Yeah, so I love that. That's become the Richard Herring. It's so funny, because again, in improvisation, all of the... teaching methods, like all of the work, the little games or whatever you play, have been taught by someone to someone else.
Yeah, of course.
So it means when you're teaching improvisation, you say, I learned this technique from, I don't know, Lauren Shearing, and then someone will say, oh, Lauren, I did your exercise this, and she'll be like, oh, I didn't do that, it's from Susan Messing. You know, so that funny thing of the chain of of where things come from. But anyway, so I tried to do that, and all it did was make me really feel shit about myself and go, because I just couldn't do it. And the reason I couldn't do it is because I'm doing other things that feed my comedy. So it's sort of like, I think that comes back to me not being a straight stand-up comedian.
Yes.
So I'm not a straight stand-up comedian. So if I spend the day working with Showstopper, improvising musicals, I'm learning skills that help me in my end up in my show, because I improvise songs and I write songs. So I had to teach myself that is also writing, if you want to use the term writing.
Where do you feel like a self-disciplined person? You do an awful lot of things.
Yes.
And I suspect, are you troubled by lack of self-belief?
That's so funny. sometimes, yeah. But like not all the time. I used to be really like terrified all the time of like, what the fuck am I doing? Because again, like, I'm so glad that, like, I'm almost 35, which again, isn't that old for a comedian. And I think every time I read someone like, go, they didn't make it till they were 40, I go,
yeah. You know?
And it's true. And I had a big epiphany when my great aunt Nellie died. So my great aunt Nellie was 104 and she died. And I used to go and hang out with her quite a lot. She was really fun. But she died. And you know, when people die, people generally go, it makes you think, doesn't it? Really got to ride the bull by both horns, take the bull by both horns, is that phrase? We've got to get on a bull and milk it. And I thought, no, that's 104. That's so long. Like, what age is? Like, why am I stressing so much about? And I think there's this like, this thing of like, until you've hit some certain goals, then you haven't been successful. Or, and also Adam Megiddo, who's the director of Showstopper, he's great. He said to me once, he said, you must notice the things that you have achieved. And I was like, oh, that's a good point.
Yes.
So making sure that, like, if I win something or I have a great show, taking the day off the next day and being like, yay me, and then getting back to work. So there's, yes, obviously the Millikan principle of, yes, you know, no good show. You know, you can't wallow in a show and you can't, yeah, ride on a show for too long.
It's not an absolute rule.
But I love that as a rule, because I think it's very important, as particularly for newer acts, I think, because when you're, you know, once you've done 10 years or so, whatever we've done now, like, you know that shit gigs happen and you don't beat yourself up so much. But when you're new, you're like, my career is over because the people of Reading didn't respond well, you know. So learning that discipline of that you're not the most amazing comedian after one good gig and you're not the shittest after one bad one is really important. But also that you can keep working and never see what you're doing, like never notice your achievements.
So let's come back to, there's so many things I want to talk about. Let's come back to this idea of discipline, of getting things done. It's like, you seem to be like a whirlwind of getting things done.
Yeah.
Now, I sometimes find when I interview improvisers, it's quite difficult because you're also fucking happy, because it's just, yeah, fun, and you collaborate, it's enjoyable, you take risks all the time, you get rewards all the time from, you know, creatively. What are you? You're doing lots and lots of things to a very high standard. And do you feel like you are a particularly busy comedian, particularly busy person?
Yeah, like sometimes, like my hat, I didn't see all the skins coming off my hands. That usually means I'm too busy. That's my sign. I'm too busy.
So, wow, a little built-in genetic early warning system.
It really is.
When my hands are flaking,
yeah, you know, I should take a day off. That's actually how I go. I literally look at my hands again.
So do you work until your hands
flake? Too busy.
Flake?
I work until... That's the name of my next album. I work until my hands flake. But yeah, so I know that. And also my voice is a bit tired. But it's just... But also, you know, it's so hard, isn't it? Because as a performer, you have to take the work when it comes in. And you know, we'll moan about it when we're busy, busy, busy. And then come September the 3rd, when we've got nothing to do, we're all like, everybody hates me, nobody loves me. Because you've got that whole week. Like Callum, my husband, it's like after Edinburgh last year, I kept getting like weepy about 3 o'clock. He was like, isn't 3 o'clock about the time you'd get a big round of applause? Because I'll be tired doing like, oh, clapping at 3 o'clock to be like...
Oh, dear.
But isn't that funny? Because you've got used to peaks in your adrenaline at certain times of the day, yes, for a month. That is a habit.
Very good
so
advice.
So at 3 o'clock,
that's
you have...
Very good.
And really noticing that time and going, oh, okay, I'm just feeling weepy because I'm used to having a round of applause at this time.
That is... To have that pointed out must make you feel so transparent.
Yeah. But also, kind of nice because it means someone who knows you really well goes, yes, don't worry, I know you're not insane. You're just, this is what's happening at this point, which is why I would always recommend not being with a non-performer or someone who's not in the same world as you, because it's so helpful having someone who's like, I remember once coming home after some gig, I can't remember what it was, and being like, oh, blah, blah, and then they didn't laugh and everybody hated me. Blah. And Cam goes, 100 people died in China today. I was like, yeah, you're right. So like, it's really good to put it all in perspective. And I think I didn't, I used to not put anything in perspective. And because I went to a school which was like, told everybody they were going to be the prime minister, like everyone's saying, you're going to be the prime minister one day. And at one point me going, I really think there's something wrong with the maths here. but it meant that we all left school, like we all have to achieve something amazing by the time we're whatever.
Yes.
And we went to my, I went to my first school reunion. So when I was 28 and was really horrified at that school reunion of how many of the girls I went to school with, not hated what they were doing, felt what they were doing was not enough. One of the girls I went to school with is a nurse in a cancer ward helping patients in their last days of life. And she said, I'm just a cancer nurse. She said, I'm just a cancer. I was like, what the hell? And but then she said, it's not as interesting as what you're doing. And you just realize how completely messed up the world is and how also that worldview. I love the idea. It took me a long time to realize, of course, because you come out of school and you go, everybody thinks like me. And then you go, actually, no, lots of people think in different ways. So how do you get rid of or you know, adapt to that lens so that you're not judging yourself in stupidly high standards? Like, it's too much. I went to school where like B is bad. B stands for bad.
Yeah, so, I did. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's very dangerous, actually. Thing to tell people. It's good because you get good GCSE results, but I'll be honest, kids, you won't get far in comedy by saying I've got an A star in German. Can I just say as well, I think I told you this, I can't remember, but I was my brother Benji, he's 11 years younger than me, so his friends are a lot younger, they came to see me in a show, and afterwards one of his friends was like, anyway, so like, tell me about your process. Sorry to go all Goldsmith on you. Isn't that amazing?
That's lovely, but I will have to cut that. I don't
why? Like it.
Well,
funny.
Because you want to be... I try to cut out anything where my guest, anything that could be seen as kind of, I'm broadcasting it, so I don't want to be self-congratulating.
But I said it. You didn't say it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Stuart, okay. Come on now. That's terrible. And that's a good example of someone worrying what other people think. But why are you worried what they think? Well, they all love you.
Back to
They're
you.
Listening to your voice.
Yeah, well, that's true. But hey, I'm not on trial. here's the thing. You seem to have a really, what's the word? You have a really fierce approach to deserving happiness.
Oh, right.
Is
yeah.
that fair?
Deserving happiness. Expand on what that means.
What am I trying to say? And I want to talk a little bit about Sunday Assembly
as
well,
do,
and how that feeds into it. But I think you are absolutely brimming with internal confidence, and you have a very naturally high status, I think.
Yeah, people
I think
say
you
that.
Are. Yeah, I think you are a powerful lady, and you have a lot of self-belief and a lot of self-determination. And when you just said to me then, but no, come on, that's you. That's a good thing, right? I wonder if there is an echo in that. Is that the voice in which you talk to yourself? Or is that, where does that voice come from? Have you done a course?
No.
I don't mean you sound like you've done a course.
That
is a good thing to which I aspire, that sensibility that you have. Where does that come from?
Well, I think we've all got the what I call the eagle of despair. So I used to have a bit in my show called The Eagle of Despair. And then I was listening to Susan and she was talking about her crab. I was like, it's okay. You know, they're different animals. They're slightly different points of view. And I love Susan. She knows. If you're listening, Susan, she knows I love her. The Eagle of Despair being, that's just like this, you know, the voice that tells you you're the shittest comedian ever. Why are you doing it? You should give up, blah, 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 blah. And I just sort of got to a point where I was like, why are you listening? Why, if you really hate this so much, why are you doing it? There's like no point. And also, do I really believe this voice? What is that voice? So really my question was more like, where's this guy coming? Where's this ego come from? Who left the window open? So then I had to counteract it by And I think actually it might have been Luke Tawson at one point, because I was doing my 2008 show, which he directed, my IFDOC Comedy Award nominated show. Everyone remembers those.
How painful to long your whole life to get nominated for the Perrier, and the one year you get nominated, it has a forgettable and complex name.
It's so funny, isn't it? Because, and now it's just called the Edinburgh Awards, so I think everyone just writes that on their poster, don't they?
Yes.
But it was a shame. And also, like, it's also, I think, because before we used to just look forward to that party because there's so much free booze, and then now the party's like, there's only 12 people invited and it's a barbecue. But anyway, I will say, so Luke, I remember I also had a bit of a whiner to begin with, so a bit of a like, oh my god, I don't know what I'm gonna do, the show might not be very good, the audience might not like me, blah, blah, blah. A real like little fragile little snowflake kind of way, and Luke, and I was going, what if they hate it, what if they hate the show, and Luke said, do you want to do the show or not, because if you don't want to do it, just don't do it, but this isn't going to help you, is it? And I was like, yeah. And that was a really good thing. No, that's when you need, those are the people you need in your life, actually, are the comedians. Yes. Who allow you to, and who notice when you're feeling shit and you need a hug, and notice when you need a punch in the face, because actually, yes, sometimes we do need a punch in the face, and you're like, why are you, you know, worrying about what that lady in the audience said to you after the gig 3 days later?
About 2.5 hours ago, at time of recording, I said out loud to myself, alone in my flat, get a grip. It really made me laugh. Yeah. But I did feel better. It reminds me of that Henning Vane used to have a bit of material about get up early in the morning,
yeah,
make a list of all of the things you want to do, and then do all of the things on the list. And I just think that I really aspire to that.
Yeah.
And you, oh, yes, okay, so you've got good people around you,
so
who
got
can
good
give
people,
you the metaphorical punch.
But also that I tell you what saved my life was The Artist's Way, which is that book. Have you ever seen that book?
Lots of people tell it to me. I have
fucking
love
that book, yeah. And I would recommend it to anyone. My friend Lucy Trodd, who's just wonderful improviser, Lucy, comedian, she said to me, and she's quite like, I call her Mother Nature, because she's so like, oh, come to me, chickens. And she said, I think you need to do The Artist's Way, but buy it, put it on the shelf, and it will call you. I was like, all right. So I did that. I put it on the shelf. And then I did the Melbourne Comedy Festival, and I really was like this. And that was my moment of, I'm doing the thing that all the comedians really want to do. I should be really excited, but I'm really not enjoying this at all. And then I was really pleased that I did the 6-week tour, because I had a lot of time on my own, doing 20 minutes of material, fine, but in beautiful places with really nice comedians, and just like was really thinking like, what do I want? Like, what is this? Why am I feeling like this? Went through that time and then got home, and the book was like, on the side, and I did it. And the thing that really helped me was Pages, because Pages is where you wake up in the morning, like Henning Venn says. So you wake up in the morning and you just write for 10 minutes or something. I think you write 3 pages freehand, and you don't think about what you're writing. You just write, and you just let whatever comes out come out. And sometimes you're just writing, fuck, blah, blah, blah. Or you might be writing, a guinea pig woke up one morning. So it might be a story. Who knows what comes out of you? And I just noticed a lot of it was quite like unhappy. But then I started to notice that I'd start going, everything's shit, blah, blah, blah. And then by the end, I've written, but you really love your life and you love what you're doing. So just get on with it. And so there was something about me needing to vent that anger, but then remember that I was
That's
having a good time.
Because you were on stage venting a lot of anger as Loretta.
Yeah. But then again, so it's like, it's almost like, I suppose maybe she was my Orville or something, or like she was saying stuff that she was venting anger, but it wasn't my anger. Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
like,
it was so it's concocted.
Like, yeah, and so yes. And also I was like, I suppose that's part of it. I wasn't angry because I was really successful with that. So I wasn't angry about that. I think I was just angry that I couldn't find my voice.
So in your stand-up, is there now a thing that you are burning to say on stage, or is your stand-up a vehicle for you to enjoy yourself by making people laugh?
I think a bit of both, Stuart Goldsmith. I think because
sorry to Goldsmith you there.
So the thing I love, so what I love about comedy is you get a room full of people who've never met each other, and they all just sit and laugh together. And to me, that's so important. And I love the fact that you can have, yeah, like people from all around the world. So you go to the 99 Club in Leicester Square. Oh, I don't think it's there anymore, is it? It's how long ago I got booked for a gym. But you'd have like tourists, and then you have like a group of people from Essex, and then some hen party, and then a business thing. And everyone just laughed together. And you go, oh, this is just so lovely. So I suppose my only message is, remember that we can all sit in a room together and laugh. Yes. And all my shows, my solo shows, have been very much, was the first one was called Pippa Evans, Don't Worry, I Haven't Heard of It Either. The second one was called There Are No Guilty Pleasures. The third one was called Same, Same, But Different. And the next one is called Joy Provision. So I think there is a link there of this happiness thing of, but, and I hate the word happy. The reason I hate the word happy is because it suggests that we all have to be walking around with a big smile on our faces. Whereas what I'm talking about is just being comfortable in the fact that we are ourselves, that we are all different, but that we can find something in common with each other. And you can find that in the room by just laughing together. I don't like having it as so much of a stamp. I think last year it was I did a bit of a stamp at the end of like, hey guys, we're all together, we're all the same, which I didn't like the ending of my show last year because I felt like it was a bit too on the nose. I don't think it needs
to be. Yeah, it's almost like the show itself makes your point.
Yeah, exactly. You don't need to I think that's the thing this year I'll definitely do is, because I hate writing the fucking Edinburgh blurb before the show. I hate that. So now you've written the blurb, and now I feel like the show I've written doesn't quite fit the blurb. And I know people don't really read that blurb, but it just annoys me in terms of someone coming, having, or not coming because they've read that blurb. My blurb's very specific, like, the world's going mad, so how can we find joy in the world? I'm like, that's not really going to come up.
That's not going to come up.
So I think if I could change anything about Edinburgh, all the entries would be Pippa Evans, title of show, just come and fucking have a go. Like, yeah. That should be the title of it. And also we should have no sections in the Fringe brochure because I hate being boxed by comedy. I'm not comedy, I'm not cabaret. I'm like entertainment, but entertainment is seen as a dirty word. So it's like, I think that's true for most people, actually. So people go, I'm doing a stand-up show, but it's got songs in it, as if like, well, then it's not a stand-up show.
Yes, rather than I'm doing a stand-up show, which, hooray, has got songs in it.
Yeah,
yes, or, which benefits from having songs in it.
Or like I do a lot of characters, but they're not necessarily characters as in, I'll break into a character through the talking rather than I've put a hat on and now I'm old Mrs. Miggins from down the road, you know? So it's like, the character stuff's still there, but people go, so you stopped doing character comedy? It's like, no, I've stopped spending a lot of money on eyeliner and pouring it down my face every week. So that thing of like, we're not, I sometimes worry that we're not allowed to evolve as performers as easily because people go, okay, this is what, Stuart, you do happy, jolly comedy, and that's what you do. And then, like, if next year you decided to do something else, and I'm like, what's happened to Goldsmith? Yeah, he's gone a bit weird. It's like, no, he's just discovering something different, a different angle of himself.
Yeah, I've often thought whatever I do when I turn up is the act. Yeah. And I feel you have to hold on to a sense of that for yourself. No, whatever. If you book me, you get me doing whatever I want.
Yeah, yeah. So interestingly for me, like, I've turned up to two or three gigs now where they've gone, we really, really wanted to book Loretta, but they say you're not doing it anymore. It's like, well, thanks a lot. That's made me feel great. Yeah. And then I go on and smash it as myself and feel like punching them in the face, but to be like, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, because it annoys me a bit because I think, well, if Loretta was an easier sell, for sure, 100%, but there's a sort of almost a dismissive thing there of like, you know that I wrote and performed Loretta May, you know that was me, right? So probably I can write and perform something else to the same standard, but it will be different. So yes, you won't be as funny in a angry American singer way,
sure,
but it will be as funny in a confused, posh, not posh person.
Have you learned this attitude of yours of, I don't mean attitude in a negative way, this attitude of, I felt like coming off and punching them in the face. Do you know what I mean? Like, and you have talked, and I don't mean this in a negative way at all. Few people on this podcast are as comfortable going, I'm really good at this, and I'm really good at that, and I know how to do that. You really believe in yourself in a way that's very attractive, in a sort of what's a word that doesn't have the connotations of attractive? Do you know what I mean? But like, it's a really inspiring kind of quality. Have you learnt that, is my question, or were you always that kid?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think a bit, I think so. Once I was on a bus and this old lady, I often talk to people on buses. This old lady said to me, did you go to Notting Hill and Ealing High School for Girls? And I said, yeah. And she goes, I said, how did you know? She said, because you have an air of apology about you, but also a sense that you might one day take over the world. And I thought that was a really good summing up of me. Yeah. I was like, oh my God, that's it. So I think there's the difficult thing of growing up, going to a school where they say everyone's going to be prime minister, and then being told never show off, never be proud of yourself, always, you know, always be humble. And you're like, I don't know how to marry these two things together. Mm. So I think I suppose I used to veer between apologetic and arrogant. So I think I used to be quite arrogant. But I was arrogant without the skills to back it up. So I think now I'm in a place where I can be confident that I can do the thing I've said I'm going to do, but also comfortable when I don't do it, like as if I fail.
Is it a sort of like a benevolent version of entitlement? Like a good,
maybe.
Like some qualities, and I hate to bring this man up, but for example, Boris Johnson has a sort of, he's got that quintessential public school kind of, well, it'll all be all right because I'm me. That kind of attitude.
Yeah, well, I don't like being compared to Boris Johnson at all. No, because I don't think he can do it. So he's bollock. He's completely talking shit because he's using that public school boy thing to make people think he can do it. But he can't do it because, as we've seen, as foreign secretary, he's like shitting his pants. And so actually, once he's been given actual responsibility, he's fucked himself up rather than what I suppose I feel like. I suppose also because I got a lot of attention very early on when I didn't have anything to give back. So, but there's a weird thing that happens when you're a new, and I think this happens a lot with new act competitions. The person who wins often gives up because they go, oh, you do a great 5 minutes. You need to be doing an Edinburgh hour in the next year. You need to be doing 20 minutes in Jonglers next weekend. And these people are like suddenly put into a world that they're not ready for. So I was working with Steve Weiner yesterday. Do you remember Steve Weiner?
Yes, I do remember Steve.
So when we did the Hackney Empire New Act of the Year, he came first. Andy Osho came second and I came third and Jack Whitehall wasn't placed. Yeah. And of that competition, Jack Whitehall is like up here, you know, it's superstar. And I'm sort of, I'm a rising star. Andy's decided to go more in an acting way.
Yes. And Steve, she's in the West End at the minute.
She is indeed. Yes. Yeah. And Steve is working in training people in communication. So he gave up comedy completely because he just did not enjoy that world. Mm. And I thought it was really great that he felt able to do that because he just wasn't happy there. But I think that happens a lot. So when I got nominated in 2008, suddenly all these TV companies are like, what do you want to do? Let's make a show. And I just was like, I don't know. So, and then they go, oh, I just really know which ones to do. And again, that thing of that should have been, oh, it's okay. You don't know what to do. Rather than, you don't know what to do. Oh dear. You're obviously not a very good comedian, which is how I felt, whether or not they were actually saying that. This is me projecting that on. But I felt like, oh no, I'm not a good comedian because I don't know how to do a television show. It's like, of course I don't know how to do a television show. I'm like 26 or so, however old I was then. Let's do some maths. 9 years. 24, 23. Yeah, so it's very young to get that much attention. And so to feel like I couldn't deliver, I think put me in a bit of a spiral of, I don't know what I'm doing, and panicking about not knowing what I'm doing rather than being happy with not knowing what you're doing.
Yes. Okay. So what other mistakes have you made along the way?
What other mistakes have I made?
And I feel like you're someone who is sufficiently confident that I can ask that without you. Is that Jimmy Savile on the wall behind you?
Yes! And the reason we have that is because that's my husband dressed as a Boy Scout stood next to Jimmy Savile.
Wow. Okay.
Jimmy Savile's holding a check like he's buying my husband.
Oh my Lord. Okay.
So creepy.
Good God. Okay, sorry. Let me focus back on what I say. I feel like I can ask you about the mistakes you've made. There are some acts who I think I don't want to ask them. What mistakes have you made in case it sends them down a path? But I think you will probably have a healthy appreciation of things that you've done wrong from which we might all learn.
I think I used to lose my temper quite a lot. I think I used to get really annoyed with when things didn't go my way. So I'd get really frustrated by, so not necessarily with people, but I think people can feel your vibes, you know. So I think I would just get really angry. I used to get really jealous quite a lot of people doing well because I felt like it meant I wasn't doing well. And again, that's something I had to work on. So me and Ruth Bratt, who's one of my bestest friends.
Yes.
And one, you're very good friends with Ruth.
Ruth is excellent.
Ruth is an excellent.
I was thinking about this because I thought Ruth might come up, and I thought, I never want the podcast to sound too plummy.
Like, oh, I see.
Giles Brandreth going, darling Ruth. But Ruth Bratt is excellent.
Darling Ruth. And and she, I can't remember what it was, but I think I was just having a bad run of, the other thing is, so again, hindsight's such a great thing, isn't it? So when I first got any attention, I was sent for these auditions for parts that I literally was not right for. And also women's parts in their 20s are fucking awful. And anyone who's writing anything, please think about women as more than just tits next door. Because every part was like, hi, I've just popped right to buy some milk. Oh, she's wearing a short skirt and she falls over. I mean, it really was like 1970s kind of stuff. And I wouldn't get it because I didn't look right, because I'm like, obviously my heart wasn't in it. But also I'd never like done these auditions and stuff before. So it was all a learning experience. But again, rather than seeing it as a learning experience, I was like, I'm shit. I'm the worst. I'm a failure. And I get really... And then I can't remember. Ruth got some part in something. I don't even think I'd audition for it. Because again, she's short. We often described... Oh, was it Scratch or Showstopper? We were described as... someone said to someone else, I really like that lady in Showstopper, not the tall statuesque blonde, the short fluffy one. And we love that description. Anyway, she got a part in something, and I was literally like, I felt myself be candid, like with rage, and I was like, why? I really had this moment of like, why am I angry that my friend who I love, who I think is brilliant, is doing well? And I thought, this is not good, is it? And I sort of sat on it for a bit. And then I sent Ruth an email and I was like, I just need to tell you that I feel really jealous and I'm really confused because I love you so much. It makes me emotional talking about it. And then she said, and she emailed me back like, of course you're jealous. You think I'm left? You think I'm... Oh, it's cool. It's so cool. It says podcast gold. And then she was like, of course you're jealous. I get jealous too. And I think just having that moment where someone acknowledged like that we're all having a shit time sometimes was lovely. Yeah. And I suppose I see that as a really important moment of my development because it's so lonely being a comedian sometimes, and so much of comedy is having bravado, and allowing yourself to be vulnerable sometimes is so important, I think.
Thank you. You're right, come on. Hey, man.
But also, like, shows you how important it is to have good friends in the business who you can trust, that you can say things like that too without knowing.
Yeah, well...
And, you know, that must have been, like, 6 years ago or something. And see, it still upsets me, but only because I feel sad for me at that point being in that situation and feeling like I'm really sad that for some reason at that point I felt like other people doing well meant I wasn't doing well. I think a lot of people suffer from that. So I do try really hard with new acts to be like, you know, don't feel like you have to beat anyone else, that we are all dancing to the beat of our own drum and we have to be happy with what we're doing. That's the most important thing, because you spend so much time comparing yourself to other people and it's so painful and destructive.
Well done for emailing her at the time and saying so and being honest about it, because I can't imagine... Well, this might be an interesting track. I can't imagine a male comic doing that. I'm trying not to be sexist, but is that a particularly... I think the way that a male comic would have handled that is to fester for 30 years and then have them on a podcast and go, hey, man, I used to really resent you. I think that's... Maybe let's... Don't worry about the gender aspect of it. But that is... Like, I would aspire to that sort of emotional intelligence of being able to say to a friend, I've realised I'm really jealous of you.
Hmm. Well, I suppose if you don't, you know, it's like anything, any good friendship relationship, you have shitty things happen and you have to acknowledge them and just go, this is how I'm feeling or what I've done. And then you have to say, and then you sort of, I think just acknowledging something actually helps break that down. Because I think jealousy is such the worst thing. I found this amazing essay and I can't remember who wrote it, but it was one of the best things I read about it. And it was like, being jealous is fine. You can be jealous. But if it lasts for more than 5 minutes, there's a problem.
Oh, that's good. That's
so it's like, of course, if you see someone doing well, you go, what does that mean about me? Because we also, the other problem is we work in an industry which relies on us judging ourselves by each other, because we're in kind of school years in a way. You're like, oh, we started together. And I remember once saying to Ben Norris, at a gig, I was like, I was the first gig I was headlining as Loretta, and he was maybe opening. And I said, this is so exciting, Ben, because the first time I ever met you, I was doing an open 10. I was doing the 10 and you were headlining and now you're opening for me. And in my head, that was like, isn't that interesting? But obviously to Ben, it was like, you're failing, I'm winning. And it was, yeah, I mean, so we, you know, and he said something to me like, well, thanks very much. but it really, again, like the, you know, the, these things happen all the time. We're constantly comparing ourselves to each other. And we have to notice these things because they are the things that fester and make you bitter. Like, we've both met a lot of bitter comedians. And I think that I had an amazing evening with two comedians. I won't name them all. But one of them was Rich Morton. And I think, again, he saved my life a little bit because I think I just did this take. I was supposed to be in this TV show. And they basically dropped me at the last minute. And it was supposed to be a big thing. And then, and you know, again, you think you're the only person who's had these experiences. And I was really hurt because I felt like we'd got so far with it. We'd done some writing, blah, blah, blah. And then it essentially was, this isn't a vehicle for you. This is a vehicle for someone else. And in many ways, it was a compliment. It was, if you're in it, they won't shine as much. But a bit of a backhanded compliment of, so therefore we're going to cut you. and so I was really like, ooh. And then I was going to this gig with these all male Bolshie men comics, and you're just like, these aren't the people I need to be with right now. And Rich Morton was there, and one of the comedians was just going on and on about everything that had fucked up in his life and how no one cared, and all the TV shows that rejected him, and I was like looking at this guy going, I'm going to become this guy, I'm going to be the guy who hates themselves and is angry with everyone. And I was looking at Rich, and he was just sitting there like calmly listening and giving good sort of you know, oh, that's, yeah, that must be hard, yeah. And then we got in a lift and we were on a different floor, me and Rich, and the lift door shut and he went, oh God, will he ever shut up? And I went, oh my God, thanks. I'm so glad you said that because I was really worried and I told him the whole story. And he went, oh, Pip, don't you worry about it. Once upon a time, I was given my own show on the BBC. They'd signed it off and everything. And then the commissioner changed and they said, we're not going to make a TV show anymore. I was broken. Oh, my life was, I was just like, what am I doing? But you know what I think? I think I'm here. It's taken me a while to get to this point, but I'm doing the thing I love. I'm paid to do it. I'm having a great time. So don't you worry about that show because that's just one thing of many things that are going to come your way. I was like, this guy is who I needed to be with this weekend. You know? What a gift to have that time with him. So he's always in my pocket of people. Yeah, good voices to put in your head when you're feeling a bit lost.
Thank you. That's lovely. I was really engaged with that, so I didn't bother thinking about the next question. Oh man, was that email to Ruth? Was that a? I'm trying to gauge how pivotal that moment was. I don't know you well enough personally to know how often you cry. I'm a very tearful person. I don't know whether that moment, like the fact that you were very emotional talking about it, is representative of the love you feel for Ruth, or the time you were, you know, the emotion you felt at the time, or whether like that was, I think you sort of said that was a key moment when you went, hang on, I've got to get a grip to myself.
It's so funny that you say that you don't know that I'm a tearful person, because I always think people think, oh God, people's crying again.
I don't get that at all.
Oh really? Oh great.
No.
I cry. Maybe I don't cry as much as I used to. I don't drink as I used to drink more than I used to. There was something also. I'm like, the amount of drinking that goes on it's changing, isn't it? The amount of drinking that goes on. A few of the mistakes I've made have been drinking too much at chortle parties. So I don't do that. I gave up white wine. So you know, Loretta Main has a song called White Wine Witch, and I love that song, and I still sing that song because that's actually, I realised, a song about me, and I used to worry that I was an alcoholic because I would drink. Not like all the time, but when I did drink, I'd drink white wine and I would just go mad and wake up and not know what I'd done and have upset people by God knows saying what, God knows what. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm an alcoholic. And I kept trying to give up alcohol. I was like, well, I seem to be fine about on every drink apart from white. If I drink white wine, I just go nuts. And so I gave up white wine. And since then, I've not had any incidents of being insane. And I was like, oh my God, that White Wine Witch song was literally me talking to myself. But subliminally going, Pippi, really stop drinking white wine. And whenever I tell people that, they're like, how could you not know that? How could you sing a song about white wine for 5 years and not realise that song was for you? Weird.
So have you seen Rick and Morty?
No.
I just want to put anyone listening to this who's seen Rick and Morty, it's this very anarchic, fast-paced cartoon. I won't go into detail on it. There's a character who is basically, there's a scene where he's young again. He's an old man. He's young again. He's at high school, but he's secretly in a cryo chamber somewhere dying. Ah. And the kid is being the cool guy in high school that he never was and getting the guitar out, except only thing he's singing is, I'm trapped in a cryo tube. Help me, kill me, kill me. It's a similar sort of message to oneself on the subconscious.
Yeah. So, I don't know. What was that? What was the question? Oh, pivotal. So I think it was pivotal, because I can't remember exactly when that happened. I remember we were in Lucy Trott's house, and she was living in Tottenham at the time. So it must have been four or five years ago, maybe. So it must have been a pivotal moment because I wouldn't remember and react like that to it if it wasn't. So yeah, but I can't really answer that question. It was definitely just a moment. I suppose it probably was all linked, because I think Melbourne... When were you in Melbourne? 4 or 5 years ago?
You were there in 2013.
I know. You've been there past in other times as well. I haven't.
No, Stuart,
you make that point.
All I mean was, I watched your Melbourne Gala clip this morning and it said 2013.
So yeah, 2013. Gosh, was it? So that's four years ago. So it must have been maybe around that time when I was already questioning what I'm doing and why I'm doing stuff that makes me unhappy.
At one point, I wanted to say, are you sure you haven't done a course? Because you're very, you know, you seem to have a very good grip on yourself.
So maybe it's a good time to talk about Sunday Assembly.
Thank you for making explicit what I was about to print into. Because I was going to say, if you hadn't done a course, probably Sunday Assembly must have some of the effects of...
Oh, yeah.
Reprogramming your software.
Well, so Sunday Assembly was... So for people that don't know, Sunday Assembly is a project that me and Sanderson Jones, who's another... Well, not really a comedian anymore. He's now a secular...
He's a full-time Sunday
Assembly secular leader. And he and I were in a car going to Comedia to do a gig. And we were talking about stuff. And then one of us said, I really wish there was a way to do church without the God bit, because we really like all that community stuff and people... Churches and on organized religion, the thing they are really good at is community and people working together. But if you don't believe in God or doctrine, then how do you manage to get that sense of community? And the other one was like, yeah, it'd be really great to try and do that. Should we try and do it? We're like, yeah, okay. So we decided to try and create church without God. And 4.5 years later, there's about 70 of them around the world.
And I should say, I don't know how completely explicit it is from you saying that you are directly responsible for. It's not that everyone else had the idea.
We are the co-founders of Sunday Assembly. And so we just came back from San Diego with the fourth international conference of Sunday Assembly. So the point of that was to find space. And I think, it's all totally linked, because it was about me not being able to find space to figure out who I am in a way that wasn't like, this is how you should be. So a lot of courses that you go on are not offering space, they're offering solutions. And actually, we don't need solutions, we need space to think and be free to consider ideas about ourselves.
If you've not done any, how do you know that?
So I've read a lot about courses. Gotcha. And I've thought about, there's a lot of them that I've clicked on and read and then gone, because a lot of them make big promises, and I just think you shouldn't make big promises.
Yes.
Because it should, again, it's like this time frame thing. In this weekend, you will learn how to love yourself, live a fuller life, get rid of those bad habits. Like, you're not going to learn that in 2 days. What you're going to learn in 2 days, you're going to get really inspired, and then you're going to fall flat on your face a week later because nothing's changed. So it's really about long-term space. So how do you find space to develop yourself if the only space available has people saying, and you must believe in this and you must believe in that?
Yeah.
It's like, actually, what about a space where we go, here's some ideas, here's some other ideas, here's some other ideas. How does that make you feel? And so the only caveat of Sunday Assembly, there is a charter, but that's only like more about how the space works. So it's like, it's not religious, but if you are religious, you're welcome. So at the front, the top of, if you go to a Sunday Assembly, no one will say, people who go to church are idiots. Because the other thing is, I went to church till I was 17, so I have a lot of respect for religious people, and half my family are very religious, and they're great people. So it's also that thing of, like, just because you believe in God doesn't mean that you think gay people should die, you know?
So I was looking at the Sunday Assembly website, and I would direct anyone towards that website, not least because it's an incredibly good website. It's really well designed.
Oh, great.
But the FAQ on it That's frequently asked questions. They are really fascinating because they you get a sense from reading the FAQ what sort of challenges you've had along the way.
You're not named on the team anymore.
I'm
the chair of the board now, which is a very formal position because I said, so when we, after the first one we did, it was really successful in Islington, like loads of people, over 200.
Hundreds of people, yeah.
Turned up and they weren't all, you know, I didn't recognise hardly any of them. And so, as you know, from gigs, like, you expect to see like your mum and your dad and a couple of friends and no one else. We'd obviously really hit on something. Sanderson, when we finished, Sanderson was like, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And I said, this is not what I want to do for the rest of my life. This is a part of what I want to do for the rest of my life. Which kind of ties into me doing lots of different things, is I'm not interested in just doing one thing because I think I'd get bored. And I like that I'm still passionate about it without it being, you know, if I get a t-shirt and I wear it over and over again, I get bored of that t-shirt, you know. So I want to make sure that I keep being fascinated by it as a project.
So describe just brief, because if Sanderson doesn't do comedy anymore, so I'm unlikely to have him on the show. So this might be our only bite of the cherry. So obviously it's an enormous project. What could I expect if I came along to a Sunday assembly somewhere?
You would expect we sing pop songs instead of hymns. And we have, instead of a sermon, we have someone doing talk about something interesting, which fits in with the motto, live better, help often, wonder more. We have a poet or someone sing a song, like a, instead of a reading. So instead of a Bible reading or a Quran reading or whatever. And we have a moment of silence as well. So everyone sits together in silence. So it's like a sort of meditative, contemplative moment. And then afterwards we have tea and cake. But then, so that's the service sort of element of it. And then outside of that, there's lots of projects, which is about peer-to-peer support. So having little groups that we meet up with on a regular basis and you check in with each other, like, how you doing? How's your life going? And also like community action. So sending people off to go and help charities and groups.
And did you sort of look at everything a church does and go, oh, that's a good idea. Let's do that without God.
Yes. So that's one of the things that's been done, and also other religions as well. So just looking at different community spaces and how they work. So it's like alternative community. Yeah. But it's about this. It's more than just like a hiking group that you will go hiking and then you go to the pub. It's like this slightly bigger element of living your life. So I think that's what's really important about it, is that a lot of people are lost and scared and they need a space where someone's going to say, where you can say, I'm lost and I'm scared, and someone will go, okay, well, let's work on that, you know, rather than, okay, here's the answer, why the weirdo, you know.
And it doesn't cost anything to attend.
No.
It's donation-based.
Donation-based, but we do, but people who come more than like three times, we sort of expect a regular donation, because it's like, you're using the service, things ain't free, you know, we still have to pay for stuff, so we do sort of.
So you get tax break status, and if you don't, does that annoy you?
I think we do get, because we're a charity, we're officially a charity.
Game on, well done.
Yeah, so... Yeah, I mean, I don't earn money from Sunday Assembly at all, I like to reiterate that. But it's really quite an amazing project that will hopefully carry on long after we're dead. And we won't figure out what it is till it's finished. But I credit Sunday Assembly with me being able to speak in my own voice, because I had to. Like, I suddenly was in a space where people were like, so it's an atheist church. And I'd be like, what? No, that's not what it is. And have to defend it. And I would get quite angry quite quickly, because people would say stupid things. And then rather than responding with kindness and that sort of hearing that someone has misunderstood it, instead I'd be like, you're a fucking idiot.
You know, like a priest would.
Yeah, like a priest. And I think I got so cross because again, it's this thing of being nebulous. So we, again, as performers, a lot of us are nebulous, but we are figuring out, we're constantly changing and evolving. And it's much harder for people to grab onto that. By people, I mean like the industry. So the minute you go into the industry, it's really hard. And I totally understand, because we as humans like it when we go, he's the gay one, he's the posh one, he's the cockney one, you know, there's the woman. So again, with Sunday Assembly, people are like, oh, so what is it? It's like church without God. You're like, well, it is based in church, but it's not exactly like church. So yes, there are elements of church in it, but as we've kind of grown, it keeps sort of morphing. The only thing it will always be is a secular space. So it's like, and that journalists don't like that.
No.
So they start sort of saying what it is, and then saying things like, are you trying to turn atheism into a religion? Just go, no, because it's not atheist. Atheists are welcome and will never be challenged on whether there is a God or not, because I'm not interested in whether there's a God or not. I am bored of talking about God.
So what interests you is the...
people who need people.
Yeah. I've often thought, and I think I'm sure said on this show, that I would like to be religious because the software seems like a really good bit of software.
Yeah.
All of the positive elements of it are really positive.
Yeah. But also
friend, confidence, community, all of those things.
And also people that will check in on you. And again, it comes back to this, having friends that you can say and be vulnerable with, and that you can, or who will call you on shit. So when you're behaving in a way that's hideous, like that, someone will go, why are you being like that? And again, not like, stop behaving like that. That's not how we behave in Sunday assembly. Being like, what's going on? Why are you being a dick?
Yeah, it's it's like an almost kind of Derren Brown technique of interrupting someone's anger. I've often wondered whether if someone were to start a fight with you in a pub and you responded with, like if someone said, are you looking at my bird? And you responded with, are you all right?
It might be
a different, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. Different energy. It really is. I remember actually once Callum was in the street and he brushed by this guy, and this guy went, why the fuck are you punching me? Why are you touching me? And he put his hand on his shoulder and went, are you all right? And the man just went, and walked away.
Yeah.
Because he was just obviously having a really shitty day and just couldn't cope with a human saying, are you all right?
So do you attend Sunday Assembly?
So this is where the Venn diagram gets messy, is because Sunday Assembly is on a Sunday morning, which is when Showstopper rehearses. So I go when I can now. So I used to go every single time and, you know, run the band and do the singing and lead all that stuff. But also for it to grow, and I really believe in this as well, for it to actually be a real thing, it has to not rely on me and Sanderson.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at the moment we still need to be at the center, as in talking, like figuring out what it is philosophically, but we don't necessarily have to be there in person at every single Sunday assembly, because if it's an idea that works, it should work without us.
Are there any downsides to it? Are there problems with it?
You know, you get any group of people, more than three people, you can't have a conversation easily. You can't have a discussion easily. There's fractions, people get into little cliques. How do you control what's going out? You know, it's the internet. There's two of us. There's three people in the office, really. And there's 70 around the world. How do they have any kind of check on them? But also, how do you check on people without being like, we're checking on you. How are you doing it right? Because it should be able to breathe. Again, it should be their space, but it has to be done within the Sunday Assembly way. So,
and the frequently asked questions, one of them is, what happened in New York?
Which is a fabulously
telling kind of a thing.
Which is so funny, because that's so old, because that happened in the first year. But again, that thing of being allowed to not like it and leave.
Yeah.
So, but a lot of what you get is people that go, I like this idea, but what I'd really like if there was no songs and if we could just talk about how much we hate Jesus.
Yeah.
You go, well, that's great. You go and do that if that's what you want to do.
Sure.
If there's space for that, I'm sure. But this isn't that space because I'm just not interested.
It's really interesting hearing you talk about it. I looked at the website, I looked at the photos. I like the idea of it. I'm very attracted to the idea. I suppose, if I'm being honest, I looked at the stuff and thought, I don't know if I would try that, because I was sort of interrogating myself on the bus. What is it? What are you finding not attractive about that? And I suppose my preconception is that it would somehow be, as bad as church. Do you know what I mean? Sort of like, maybe it's not the God that I don't like about church. Maybe as someone who was made to go to church as a kid at school, you know, maybe it's not the God I don't like. It's almost like I don't want to turn up and discover that it's as shiny faced as I found church.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I suppose in a way it is shiny faced, but we do have talks about not shiny things, like, you know, death and stuff. So it's like really tackling life stuff. But it is quite shiny. And the reason for that is there's a reason that I was a Baptist, not a Roman Catholic. So one is very shiny and one is not. And I'm quite a shiny person. Like, I like songs and stuff. So it's going to have that element in it. So it is about, I suppose that is the show bit. That is the bit that you come and you celebrate life there. You celebrate it. And actually a lot of people find it's really nice to be in a room with 400 people singing.
Yeah, it does sound pretty great.
It's really fun.
I remember I emailed you regarding my wedding.
Oh, yes.
I said, that's our most recent contact. I said, we're having a bit of a group sing-along. Can you suggest some songs? And you sent me back a text that was like, yeah, I get asked about this a lot.
Yeah, I do. And I don't mind because I love the fact that I find it really funny that I've become go-to wedding, secular wedding sing-along girl.
Yes.
So because our wedding, we had When I'm 64 by the Beatles instead of a hymn. And I think it's really, because again, there's something about us all singing together. It's lovely. And there is something we really as humans enjoy about making noise together. Like when you look at football, all the chanting and stuff, that's, you know, that's all tribal behaviour. We're all looking for our tribe.
I looked at the Pippa Evans and Other Lonely People video on YouTube. There's like an old showreel from years and years ago, eight, 9 years ago. And from the different characters that you were doing there, I did wonder, it's almost like one of your characters could almost be a sort of an Islington girl who's come up with a secular church. Do you know what I mean?
Which one's that? The one who's door knocking?
No. I don't mean a specific character.
Oh, I see.
Almost like that. I could see you having come up with a character who'd have had that idea.
Yeah, and Richard Marsh got in touch. He's a comedy writer.
Oh, I know Richard.
And he said, "Oh, can I pick your brains? Because I'm writing a sitcom about a secular church."
Okay.
So it is being done. I don't think I could, because at first I was like, oh, is that weird for me to give it? But actually I couldn't write a sitcom about it because it's too real. Like so a lot of people thought because we're two comedians that it was a joke.
Yes.
And someone got in touch going, guys, just want to let you know that my Edinburgh show is also a church theme thing. And we're like, yeah, it's not an Edinburgh show. also, a lot of comedians. And I bet this, because what made me laugh listening to your podcast was when you go, and here's the code for you to say that you want to be on the show, but to get me to separate the comedians who just want to be on it from the ones who actually listen to it, which made me laugh. Because then I got loads of comedians being like, hi, Pippa. Sorry, I haven't seen you for ages, but just wondered if I could get 10 at the Sunday Assembly gig. Like, what the fuck do you think it is?
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah, that is interesting. Like it could almost be a kind of Andy Kaufman-esque prank where you do a big rug pull 10 years from now.
And I've, when it started, I had a massive, again, a crisis of confidence because I was like, what is it? And people getting confused. And so sometimes when I do radio interviews for promoting something like solo shows or whatever, they go, and now let's talk about Sunday Assembly. And I go, well, no, because it will confuse the shit out of your listeners. They'll be like, so is this solo show a sort of, like feel like a pyramid scheme or something, you know, like they're going to come to my show and then I'm going to sell them Sunday Assembly. So I think, again, so I keep those things very separate, but there is obviously a lot of me in both of those things. And I think if you went to Sunday Assembly and then you came to my comedy show or vice versa, you would see the same, sort of naive joy. That makes sense. So I think Sunday Assembly is a naive idea that is getting stronger. So it's a naive idea based in truth at the moment. So by that, I mean that it is only an idea and we have to be okay with the fact that there will be things that go wrong, that there will be schisms. There will be some people that don't like it. There'll be some people who love it so much they're almost holding it too tight and you need to prise their fingers off it. There's so many great people involved with it. I can't begin to tell you. And we have to allow that to fail in the same way that I had to learn to allow myself to fail as well.
Again, the way in which you're talking about it is sort of a bit post doing a course on how to talk about a thing. You're so you sound so mature in the way that you are talking about it. It has to be its own thing. Some people want to know this. And I'm just interested, is that learned or is that innate? Do you just see the world like, well, obviously, if I create my own secular church, then some people will hold it too closely. Do you know what I mean?
Well, it's learned through experience, maybe, rather than, you know, so it's been 4.5 years since Assembly Project. And so we're only just starting to see. So I've got this line when I teach improvisation, I always say it's really hard to teach improvisation because a lot of it's about feeling, like a lot of it's about connection. And the best improvisation, so this is like theatrical improvisation versus like, oh, I'm a chimney. and so a lot of it's about feeling. So I would say the audience don't know what it is, but they definitely know what it isn't. And the same thing with us, we often go, that doesn't feel right. So it's definitely not that. Now we'll try something else. It's not that. And we're sort of slowly shuttering down onto what it actually is.
Yes.
And I think that's the same with our voices, with our choices in life, with our opinions, with our politics, whatever it is. But we have to, that line kind of has to be made of, I don't know, jelly or something. Like, it can't be, it shouldn't be a strict line, or maybe even a circle. I'm doing an image of a circle with my hands, but I don't know, there has to be that give in it as well of it can go a different way. There is no one path, Stuart.
You're about to do Joy Provision, your new Edinburgh show,
yes,
in the Cabaret Bar.
Yes.
In the Cabaret Bar.
Yeah,
what's that,
180.
Lunchtime
Jim
show.
Jim Bowen.
What time?
Yeah, I love lunchtime shows. I'm all about the afternoon slot. It's so much nicer. And also, I think because I'm not an aggressive or sweary, really, comedian, it's quite family. I'm quite family. So, so I think it suits me better than drunk stag parties will never... Well, no, I think they would have a good time. In fact, that's a lie, because lots of Bannermans, loads of stag parties came, but they weren't quite drunk enough. They weren't drunk yet.
Because it's early enough.
Because it's early enough.
Yeah,
exactly.
Great.
So I have...
Great.
Yeah, so I really...
You've got to really commit to fucking up a lunchtime show.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But I wanted to move from free fringe to back to paid fringe because I absolutely love Bannermans, and Bannermans was 100%... where I learned to be myself on stage. And I love the gang there, like Christian, who runs the bar and everything. They're just like so relaxed. I mean, it's a heavy metal, but there's nothing. He was so funny that, like, because I get a lot of Radio 4 audience, because I do a lot of Radio 4, these people would be coming in and be like, excuse me, do you have a Pinot Grigio? And he's like, we've got two wines, red or white. So I really enjoyed being there, and they were so good to us. But I think now the thing that's missing from my show is the pizzazz. And so I need proper sound and proper lights. So, cause it's a room in a pub, and they really kind of let me use their sound system, but it's a heavy metal sound system, not a showbiz sound system.
Yeah.
And also there was one light, it was a floodlight, and you had to flick it on and off from the wall. So, when I did my run at the Soho of Same, Same, But Different, the thing that was different about it was that it just had that extra element of professionalism, which is lights and sound.
Yes.
And it just makes a big difference.
Which, as a show person.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a thing.
Oh, for sure. And if I was a straight stand-up, Bannermans would be absolutely, I would never leave it. I would never leave it. Trevor Locke's been after me every year, and he's like, I'm never leaving.
Yeah.
Because it's so good. The other thing is, I feel like with the free fringe is such a gift for us that if you have a space and you... And so I was like, people having to like push people, or like people had to leave, so much so that health and safety came down and then stopped letting me fill the room. So I ended up having just 60 people at a time rather than 120 because of fire regulations. Oh, who's going to have a fire in a damp cave? But then, so it meant that the room, it was annoying because when it really was full, it was just joyous.
Yeah.
But I think that if you are overflowing a room, give that room to someone else and move to somewhere else, which is bigger. Like, take the plunge, like, be brave, you know,
Well, this is my question. Do you feel that you, like, how are you feeling? How confident are you about switching from a free 60 to a paid 180?
Yeah.
That's a big gear change.
It's a big gear change, but I sort of feel like, you know what? If the Pleasants believe in me enough to put me in there, for one, that's really a confidence boost. And also, obviously, we have the same agent, the wonderful Chambers, and they, if they believe in it enough to do it, then that's fine. I also think that it's great that people will come to your show for free. Now is the chance. Now is the time to check. Will you pay to see me?
Mm.
And if they won't pay, then let's think about that. Like, why don't they want to pay to see you? Yeah, that's another conversation to have, isn't it? It's like, well, if they don't pay, if they're not paying, what are you not doing that's making them not pay?
I think what I've noticed in the last few years is obviously there's more and more acts are coming from the paid fringe to the free fringe.
Mm.
Most people listening to this will know exactly what we're talking about, but on the free fringe there is no disincentive for an audience member who doesn't know you to try out the show, because they can wander in or out of their own behest. And on the paid fringe, you know, once, I don't know what your ticket price is, but it's not uncommon to be between 10 and 14 or 15 quid in a big venue, I mean. And I suppose in the last few years, I've seen lots of acts move from the paid fringe to the free fringe, thinking, hey, I don't want to lose £7,000 to be up here. I want to go home with a couple of quid because I'm performing. Now, you, I think, are the first person, I don't think you're the first person to ever do it, but you're the first person I've spoken to about that specific change back hoping they come with you.
Well, I suppose also there's a thing about what for me, the free fringe is the place to experiment. And that's why we need the free fringe, because you can't experiment on the paid fringe anymore because it's such a big gamble because of money and everything. So I had 3 years on the free fringe trying out. And I feel like if I'm taking it seriously, and I would like people to then pay for a tour, then I think there's just something about showing the audience something with pizzazz rather than, so a lot of people say, you're too good to be on the Free Fringe, which annoys me as well, because you're like, there's loads of really freaking excellent people on the Free Fringe, but I know that I need that tech thing. And I think there's something about transitioning back. So I've experimented. Now I feel like I've found my voice. Let's put it out there with all the bells and whistles and see what happens. And we'll just see what happens. That's about as far as I've thought it through. I mean, I could be worried about it, but I feel like it's a lot of energy. I haven't got time to be worried about it. I'm too busy. My hand, look at that flake of skin on my hands. So I suppose I could. There's obviously the. So again, I have the little voice in my head that's like, no one's ever going to come. It's going to be awful. It's going to be Trump. The thing I do like about the cabaret bar as well is you could have 50 people in there.
It would still feel like a
I think it's that. And I think it's also about not beating myself up if it's only 100 a day. One of the worst experiences for me on the Fringe was when I moved Loretta into a bigger venue. And that was for me, the nail in the coffin was I moved from the Caves to the George Garden thing, to a tent. And there was just like no sign. I couldn't afford the posters. And it was just hot. It was just horrible. And I was in 150 seater and I had like maximum 50 people in there. And it was horrible because it's like so much energy that I was just having to fill that whole room with my energy. Everyone would be going, "That's such a great show. It's such a shame nobody came to see it." But I thought, if this is what happens to Loretta with publicity, so I'm still paying a PR person and all that, and supposedly in a better sort of space, you know, more prestige and all that bollocks, but Pippa Evans is selling is rammed, even though my title is Pippa Evans, don't worry, I don't know who I am either, is filled every day in Bannerman's. That shows to me that the weight is with Pippa Evans, not with Loretta Mayne. And so I feel like now is the time to do the opposite of that seesaw.
Yeah.
So I think like a lot of comedy is seesaw. So Ken Campbell, who we work with on Showstopper, used to say, if you're going to make it up, it better be better than if it's written down. Yeah. So we worked Showstopper to the point that we can improvise this to the standard of a written show. But that means that if you can improvise to that point, if you can improvise to the point that's better than it's written down, you better be able to write to the point better than you can make it up. Does that make sense?
Okay, yeah.
So I'm at the point where my writing and my improvising are of the same level, and I had to work to get to that point.
Showstopper is an incredible show. I've seen it several times, and I think it is absolutely the show that you can go back to and go back to and go back to. You did a West End run of it.
Yep.
I was talking to Ruth about the financial implications of it and how it doesn't make you very much money.
No. But it pays. It does pay, but it doesn't make as much money. And I think,
given that it's like a huge West End production, Ruth was explaining to me the numbers involved in how many people are involved in making it happen.
Yeah, and also that we were paid equity minimum. So people say it doesn't make you much money. It makes you as much money as being in a chorus of a show does, and that's how much money it should be making you, because we're all the same. So that's the other thing is. It's quite interesting being in it, because obviously as a solo performer, it's all about being the star. And as a improviser, it's all about us being the same. So
yes, but in a chorus line, the person in the chorus line didn't create the material they're doing. The person who created the material they're doing is sitting on a huge pile of money.
Yeah. Luckily, there's no one sitting on a huge pile of money, because you can never make any money from the material because it's gone. So it's not like Les Mis, where you can sell the CD forever, sell the music. People tour it. They do it in schools. There's all that stuff going on. You can never tour the show we did last night, Up It, a Chaffinch family in a tree in Cambridge. So there's also that thing, isn't there? Any gig or any show you do has to be for one of the four Ks: kicks, kudos, cash, or creativity.
What? Whose is this? I love it.
So it's a bastardization of something musicians often say. Showstopper's not about cash, but it is about kicks, kudos, and creativity for sure. We all love doing it. It definitely buzzes our minds, and people now go, "Oh my god, you're in Showstopper!" Although for the beginning, it was like, "What's Showstopper?" And now people are like, "Oh my god, Showstopper!" So and it's great for me because it's in the Grand, so that's a 750 seater, and then they will see me, and then they can come to my solo show, and so that's a great crossover marketing thing for me. So from a selfish point of view, it's a great thing, but also just as a show, I don't think there's anything that I'm prouder of than Showstopper.
I can't ask you anything else about it, because it's improv and it's just brilliant. I mean, I can't ask you how you do it. How do you do it?
No, it's just skills. It's like being a good footballer. It's like you just practice. That's it. And improvisation is a really good. The reason it's so good for you is, again, as a control freak and someone who has been like angry and frustrated by other people in the past. You have to fail. You have to accept other people's offers. You have to do what's maybe not what you want to do. You have to be taken in a different direction. And I think that was something I struggled with, because at the beginning, so when I first started doing comedy, I was like, I want to have a TV show like Victoria Wood. That's what I want. And then as I started doing comedy, I realized that that's not what I wanted at all. And I didn't know what I want, which is a bit like this thing of the audience knows what it is, but they definitely don't know what it is, but they definitely know what it isn't. So I definitely knew it wasn't that, but I didn't know what it was. And Showstopper started dragging me in this way. I started doing more improvisation and started to wanting to do like, all this stuff. And I started to feel like, oh no, I'm being dragged down this improvisation kind of more nebulous comedy path, but I want that TV show. So I've, instead of going, oh, it's okay, this is the way we're going, I was going, the vision is going, rather than just going, fuck that vision. It's not your vision anymore, babes. It's gone, done. And if those things happen, then that's fine. But it has to go from a place of joy rather than a place of, I really need a TV show. Yeah.
In terms of stand-up, are there any bits of someone else's stand-up that you wish you'd written? Is there a bit that you covet?
Oh, I don't know. I don't covet bits so much as I just really... So, you know, Fumbi, I could never say anything he says because he says it all as a black man. But he did a really funny bit the other day. I'll bastardize it, but just about the police stopping a party and the police saying to him, like, just tell your friends that we're not all that bad. And him wanting to say back, how about you tell them that we're not all bad? I really thought that was really funny. I just admire a lot of people. And so it's less about individual lines, but I love the way Sean Collins sits on a stool. Like, I just find that hilarious. I wish I could sit on a stool. There's no way I could sit on a stool.
Plenty of stools in the cabaret bar. Give that a try.
I saw Susan Corman's show at the Soho Theatre and I loved her energy. I loved the fact she was just there, because I'm always in the room before the show. Like, I always greet my audience. I like knowing my audience and I like saying hello. And when I came into her show, she was already on the stage and I thought, oh, that's an interesting way of doing the same thing. And it just means that you're just like, we're just here. We're having an hour with Susan. That's it. And I really like that kind of casual way of it rather than the, please welcome to the stage. You know, that kind of, I'm so special. Hype. It was more like, come in now, let's talk about some things, off you go. I love that. I think Al Murray is amazing, and he did a thing where he had a plant in the audience, and me and Rachel Paris and Gemma Arrowsmith, and I think Ruth as well, we alternated being the singer in the audience who's like, who, me? And then getting up and smashing a song out of the park. And I just loved his whole show. Like, I just love his audience reaction, interaction really speaks to me, and I love audience. I think I find it amazing to go to a show and there be no interaction with the audience. I think, why the fuck are you being, why are you being live? Why be a live show if you never even acknowledge the fact there's people in the room? I went to a theatre show the other day and it was so fucking awful. I wanted to stand up and go like, what are we doing? Surely no one's enjoying this. And I find that funny. Like, why have we been conditioned not to speak? Like, everyone just sits there and suffers in silence. I quite like it. People always ask about heckling and stuff, don't they? But I was like, well, I don't like heckling, but I do love joining in. I love it if I'm talking about something. Like, I did a really funny joke about Stacey Dooley. It's a whole bit about Stacey Dooley and sort of about how she's not the best journalist in the world. And this woman went, I really like Stacey Dooley. And I was like, well, I really don't like Stacey Dooley. And then we just had this great little conversation where we sort of decided whose opinion was more important, the person in the audience or the person with the microphone. And I just really enjoyed that moment. So I love anyone who can do good audience interaction. Rob Broderick, I could watch him improvise raps for days and days and days. I will just sit here and list a million people that I think are amazing.
Okay. I'm fond of asking people whether they got what they wanted out of comedy. I suspect that you have.
How can you even ask? I'm only like 10 years in. How can you even answer that question? That's a crazy question. Have you got what you want so far? That sort of suggests that there's just one thing that you want, though, isn't it? So I suppose what I've got out of comedy is the ability to not be so fixed on what I want. Maybe that's what I've got out of comedy, is getting rid of any fixed idea of what it should be giving me.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you, Stuart Goldsmith.
What time is your Pleasance Cabaret Bar show? This year's Edinburgh Festival.
Of course. My show, Joy Provision, is at 2:40 p.m. at the Cabaret Bar in the Pleasance Courtyard, and Showstopper is at 6 p.m. in the Grand. Oh, and I should also plug the Glenda J Collective, which is a improv super troupe, which is me, Ruth Bratt, Meet the Woman Who Made Me Cry, Josie Lawrence, of Whose Line Is It Anyway, and Carrie Ad Lloyd, and we do an hour improv show, which is just the most fun, and I'm just on it. I mean, I could have talked about that for 2 hours.
When is that?
That's at 11 p.m. and it's only the 3rd to the 5th, so it's the first three nights of the weekend, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. And my own show is called Like I Mean It, and it's on for free at the Liquid Rooms Annex. It suddenly sounded alien in my mouth, but it is called the Liquid Rooms Annex, which is where I was last year at 3:45 p.m. I will no doubt mention it on the accompanying blurb of the show, but you know, while we're in the room, let's get it done. Ladies and gentlemen, Pippa Evans.
Bye.
So that was Pippa.
Thank you so much to her for coming on the show. And please, if you listened to that, if you enjoyed it, do not miss out on her Edinburgh show. And she may well be touring after that. You can also see her in Showstopper at Edinburgh and the West End and on tour and all over the world. But don't miss out on her stuff. She really is an absolutely effervescent performer. Just one of those people that walks on stage and you immediately relax and think, oh, this is going to be brilliant. So lots more interviews coming up soon. Still in the can, Orlando Baxter, Joe DeRosa, the lost episode from last Edinburgh Festival. I shall chuck that one out soon too. Barry Cryer, Simon Munnery, and plenty more besides. So send in your donations, /donate. You can donate via the medium of buying a t-shirt at /merch at the discounted price for one more week. Or another extra week if, in fact, it takes me a while to sort out a ladies' price sizing. Not price, a ladies' sizing comparison chart, because I didn't realise that was a thing, and now I realise it's a thing, so I'm trying to get on that. And that is all of that. Do come along to Everyone's a Comedian. I will give you the date for that as soon as possible. You can stay in touch by joining the Facebook group for this podcast, and you can suggest guests and your questions for guests that I've got coming up. I had an incredibly nice text from a direct message on Twitter from Ross Noble recently. So Ross is in my mind. Go and see Ross if he's touring at the moment. I'm not sure. Or check out that episode from the archives if you would like to hear what a profoundly warm, supportive and a very funny performer he is. But I think after I spoke about being nervous, he got in touch with me after I spoke about being nervous before my interviews. Some of you have got in touch and offered various things and solutions to that. I should say the nerves aren't performance anxiety so much as sort of the fear of being caught. So I suppose it is still imposter syndrome. And I know I've got all these solutions for imposter syndrome, all of this remember your value stuff. But it still makes me very tense. I've got a bunch of interviews coming up in Montreal. I'm very lucky going back to the Montreal Comedy Festival soon. And I can't wait. I'm looking forward to it. But at the same time, I've still slightly got the horrors because of the nerves, because of the interviews. Because what if my guest... I don't know what if. I don't know what it is I'm talking about. I would listen. There's plenty of places for this chat. This isn't necessarily one of them. I'll post amble at you in just a minute if you're still around. But for now, that concludes the actual podcast itself as a thing. Speak to you soon. So as you can hear, I've yet to resolve this thing. I've had a weird bundle of nerves this weekend. So I did Glastonbury, which is a huge amount of fun, as it invariably is. The first 2 days we were there, we go very early because we work there. The first 2 days we were there, the sun was baking and painful and very difficult to deal with the wee screaming boy and me and the wife looking at each other and thinking, we are terrible parents. Why did we bring him here? And then he perked up and had the time of his life. So that was nice. But, very physically demanding, as the festivals are if you spend ages at them. And the shows I really enjoyed. I emceed the cabaret tent, which is huge when rammed and huge and empty when empty, as it sort of flows and fluctuates throughout the day. That was loads of fun, and many thanks to everyone, Charlotte and everyone, the team and Haggis, and all the people that work backstage and produce that glorious event. But nervous about it because I because it's such an unknown quantity. And it strikes me that performing, and sorry again for the state of my voice, I just, you know, it's not even just staying up late and drinking and shouting. It's just exhaustion. But it is also those three things. I suppose there, it's that old question, isn't it, of if you get used to something, if you get used to a particular type of performance. We're all walking a tightrope, aren't we, between doing the same old thing and taking too many risks, aren't we? We're all somewhere on that. We're all going to either go, oh no, this is my show, this is the 20 I do, bosh, there it is, take the roof off. And that's one end of the spectrum. And on the other end of the spectrum is, got to create new material, got to take risks, got to not be staid, got to take risks in the room. Someone says something, I've got a great joke about that thing. Do I say that great joke I've said 100 times, or do I dive in and take a risk and try and go further? Everyone is somewhere on that spectrum, aren't they? And I suppose, because I respect and value all of the potential phases of that spectrum, if a spectrum has phases, you know, all of those different things you can do when someone says, it's just by way of an example, you say, what do you do for a living? They say, let's use the Al Murray example. I talked about this in my interview with him. He asked someone what they did. They said, I'm an actuary. He said, reary. And I hold that to be one of the single best pieces of improvisation. I've spoken to him. The first time he said it, it was improvised. So let's use that as an example. Once that joke is then in your back pocket and you come across an actuary again, you have a split second to decide, do you do your old joke, you know, which was once beautiful and creative and new, and then maybe it's 100 times later, or 10, whatever, 50 times later, 20, 2 times later. Everyone's got a particular place on the scale, isn't it? We're like, oh, that was a moment. It was great. Bang, it happened. It was incandescent. Let's leave it and move on. The more craven idea is to hang on to it forever and keep using it forever. And if someone says that, you know, 1,000 gigs later, there it is. That's what I always say. And I suppose the frustrating thing is that there is no right answer. And so for me, I have yet to make a decision. I've yet to make the decision as to which of those numerous different people or acts I am. So therefore, I think I sometimes go into performative situations feeling like I haven't made my mind up yet. And maybe that's what contributes to performance anxiety, to the nervousness. Because I do that sense of being keyed up on the day before a gig, especially at a festival. You spend the whole day trying to relax and enjoy yourself, knowing your gig is over your head, knowing it's looming, it has a looming quality. And I enjoyed both of them enormously. I compared on the Saturday and then did a set on the Sunday. And the set was terrific fun. And even that, I mean, you know, I've spoken about this before. With this new show, it's more personal. It's more honest. There are fewer slick punchlines. And that's what I want. I want to go away from just going, joke, joke, bang, joke, 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 joke. And I want to be more myself. I passionately want to be more myself. And now is the speed wobble stage, isn't it? It's like, is this working? Did this work? Did this whole year of new writing technique and new approaches to it, is this going to bear fruit? And if it does, what fruit does it bear? You know, if I go and have a terrific Edinburgh, does that mean I was right? If I go and have a dreadful Edinburgh, does that mean I was wrong? Or is the genus of the idea, that germ of the idea, is that pure despite the reaction? Oh my God, what am I talking about? You know what I'm trying to say. Sometimes in science, you look for a specific reaction and then you know whether that reaction happened or not. And then you go, good, this means X, Y, Z, the project was a success or a failure. In art, it isn't like that. I suppose what I'm saying is I'm trying not to be slick anymore. And the slickness, I think, was there for a reason. And I think the reason was, if I've got a perfect routine in my back pocket, then I don't need to be scared. And what I'm trying to do these days is go, I don't need to be scared anyway, because I'm good. So rather than honing and scripting and crafting a perfect routine, actually say what you mean and get closer to some bigger truth, some bigger, more important thing. And then you're halfway along the journey, you know, maybe not halfway even, but you're on that journey
And then you do a show and a bit kind of goes, yeah, people look at you like, yeah, that seems true, but we're not laughing. And then the craven part of you is like, oh God, I better get back to the slick stuff. I better get back to all the things that work, that save me, that make it okay. And you have to forge ahead anyway, don't you? You have to recognize that and go, no, be sillier. I think I've said that on stage once or twice in the previewing of the new show. I think I've said that to audiences, that I've just like, I've said something along the lines of, just once or twice, I've said something like, this is difficult, isn't it? Because half of you are just looking at me going, why are you saying this? And the other half are going, do it harder. And then that normally gets a laugh, because obviously that sort of refers to a true tension in the room. So far, so noodly. I had a really good time at the festival, and it's really lovely to stretch the material by doing it in such wildly different places. You know, I did on the Monday, I did the second Hell Week preview to about 15, 20 people in a tiny room. And then some of that material was in the set that I did and the comparing stuff I did at Glastonbury to an enormous tent at one point with only the same 20 people in it, but at one point with considerably more. So here we are. Will I listen back to this one midway through Edinburgh and go, oh, well, I know the answer now. You just don't know, do you? You never know. And you just forge ahead anyway, going, I think I've got a sniff of something. I think this is the right thing. And who knows? Even by my standards, I'm going to turn this into a catchphrase. That was a rambler, even by my standards. I feel like I've said that more than once. That's all good. It was terrific taking the boy around. He had a wonderful time running around and interacting with various pieces of walkabout theatre, some of which appeared to welcome interaction, some of which initially appeared to welcome interaction, and then it turned out they didn't especially. But he had an absolute whale of a time, whether meeting 10-foot-tall stilt puppet creature pelicans, or not pelicans, flamingos, or whether just looking at a painting of a daisy on a bin. What a great time we all had. Really special kind of family experience to be in our own little family, as well as the wider circus and theatre family of that festival. And we all had a lot of fun. Thank you if you're a couple of the people, if you're one of the people who turned up, three or four of you, I think, turned up over the festival and said hi or made cash donations or said something cool. One of you, whose name I didn't catch, walked up and donated whilst I was emceeing on stage. And I have to admit to being very, very confused. I think it was the first section of me emceeing, so I haven't even made a relationship with the audience yet. And someone walked up and just started talking to me as I was trying to perform to hundreds of people. I mean, guys, thanks for the money, but don't do that. I sort of assume a certain level of sophistication from you all. But I can't imagine that'll happen again. Do not turn that into a running joke. I thank you. That'll do me for now. Thanks for listening. If you have been, I hope by the next time I speak to you, I'll be in much finer fettle vocally. I'm going off now to drink water, gargle TCP, and hopefully get over this hay fevery cold. And I'll speak to you soon. Bye for now. Oh, God. Hey, there it is. I don't know if you heard this bit, Daryl. Sorry, that was me thinking that my phone had gone blank and it wasn't waking up, and that was me thinking that I just recorded all of that to silence. To silence, not to silence. To, you know, to no one.